Hello, I'm Muriel, and I love true crime.
I'm Nick, and I am not a fan.
Thank you for joining us. Each week, I force Nick to listen to me tell him a story of a true crime. Welcome to Muriel's Murders. Today, we're talking about a bizarre murder triangle involving two teenage girls and a chubby, Elvis-looking Svengali. The 1985 murder of Linda Brown took years to untangle and expose the inner workings of a cult-like family with a closet full of skeletons. That would be metaphorical skeletons, Nick.
Okay.
We're covering this story in two parts. Part one opens with the murder of Linda Brown and the investigation into the strange and shifting world of her family unit, ending in the conviction of her amnesia-suffering 14-year-old stepdaughter. Part two is up early on our Spotify and Patreon channels right now as we speak, and it covers the unmasking of decades of family secrets and a second explosive, incredibly overly ambitious murder-for-hire scheme. So, what do we do? Hold on to your butts!
Very good. Muriel, you're
for this two-part episode.
You're doing great. This is awesome.
Nick,
yeah.
I read my first Anne rule book. Okay, so I never have. She's like the queen of true crime, right? And man, is she good.
Is she? That's awesome. I don't think I actually know that name.
Really?
Anne Rule? I don't think so.
Oh, she's been writing forever, for decades. Uh-huh. She is just great. This book was like over 600 pages, and I just breeze through it. She's fantastic.
Because every time I was talking to you this week and you were reading, you were just like, I still have 100 pages left to go. I sure didn't catch any of that breeziness.
How about you just don't tell my business in the street? sounds good to me. Okay. Yum, yum. So our source material is If You Really Loved Me by Anne Rule. Find it wherever you get books.
Okay.
It's great.
Okay, speaking of yum yum, we want to thank Rachel S. for supporting this podcast by signing up for our Patreon. If you, our beloved listener, want to be as cool as Rachel S., check out the links in the show notes of this episode. You just press a little hyperlinks, boom, you get just magically transported to a website where you can unlock exclusive episodes and get immediate access to part two of this series. Plus, you also unlock the power of supporting this show.
Whoa.
Yes, it's just like you can feel the force within you. You
crazy,
know what I mean?
Man.
Let's talk about If You Really Loved Us. Okay, anyways, we want to shout out all of our listeners from across the globe. Australia, Mongolia, Germany, Nigeria, Dallas, freaking Texas, just to name a few of the hot spots of listener activity. Man, we really feel the love and we're sending it right back at you.
All right, this is a true story involving murder, violence, drugs, adult themes, etc. So if any listeners are like Nick and they don't want to hear about those kind of things, go listen to a different podcast.
We're going
to
joke, we're going to curse, and if you think that's inappropriate or terrible, it's all good. Please turn us off.
All right, Nikki, are you ready to hear this story?
No!
Okay, you liar, let's get started. Our story starts about 12 miles from the ocean on the coast of California on a wildly green and flowery block of bungalows and single-story houses in a white-collar neighborhood. On March 19th, 1985, a 911 call was placed from a home in Garden Grove, California in the early morning hours to report a shooting.
Uh-oh.
The first person on the scene was a patrol officer for the Garden Grove Police Department who happened to be nearby. The block didn't have any streetlights, so he walked alone in the dark up to the manicured lawn of David Brown's rented green stucco house on Ocean Breeze Drive around 3:30 in the morning. So apparently there was a victim of an unspecified gunshot wound inside, along with whoever called the police. Mm-hmm. The shooter apparently was nowhere to be found. And the whole neighborhood was really eerily quiet. Officer Darrow Halligan had beaten the ambulance and the other marked police cars to the scene. So there were no sirens or lights, no nosy neighbors gathered on the grass yet. No one panicked on the sidewalk. Mm-hmm. No noises, no screaming. A short, squat man came out of the house to meet the officer, followed by a blonde teenager carrying a baby, and both of them were crying. David Brown, the man, was only 32, but through a steady diet of McDonald's and cigarettes, he had managed to age his face and body at least a decade older than his calendar age.
So he looked my age.
He was soft, overweight, very sweaty, his skin sort of torn up from deep pock marks, had shaggy, black, thinning hair that was plastered to his neck, and then is just constantly surrounded by a cloud of cigarette smoke. Mm-hmm. He religiously wore a $1,500 custom-made pendant of a phoenix rising from the ashes. And this was his power animal, emblematic of his indomitable spirit.
A pendant? Like a pin?
No, like a big ass.
Oh, like on a necklace. Yeah, like a
Flavor of Flav.
Oh, hell yeah. Okay, cool. Because I was like, that just didn't make sense to me, like the old church lady pin or something.
Yeah.
Pendant. I don't know what I thought. I don't know if I know what a pendant is. Maybe you don't know what a pendant is.
No, a pendant is a thing that hangs on a chain. Like a diamond pendant. Okay.
Sorry, Miss Queen of Bling. My bad. Okay. I got this image. Okay. The Phoenix, a custom-made chain. All right.
Yeah. David Brown was the husband of the victim, 23-year-old Linda Marie Brown. Mm. The teenager following David around was 17-year-old Patricia Patty Bailey. Patty was the victim's younger sister. So she's pretty. She has this long blonde hair and she looks just like her sister. They almost look like twins. Mm-hmm. And Patty is just devastated, sobbing. She's beside herself. And in her arms, she held Crystal, her niece, the 8-month-old baby of Linda and David. Okay.
Oh, so yeah. Okay.
David, Patty, and Linda lived together in the house with Crystal, along with one other person, David Brown's 14-year-old daughter from a previous marriage, Cinnamon Brown. And Cinnamon lived in an old trailer in the backyard, and Cinnamon was missing.
Okay.
The first thing out of David Brown's mouth was, "I think my wife's been shot. She's in the bedroom. I'm afraid to look. Officer, would you?" So apparently, after all this time, no one had even checked to see if Linda was still alive.
Yeah.
So Officer Halligan had alarm bells going off. He had this guy who had just left his wounded wife in a dark back bedroom. He still didn't have any backup. And no one knew who or where the shooter was, but the victim could still be alive. So he pulled out a flashlight, and then following David's directions, he walked alone through the dark house to the bedroom.
That's brave.
Yeah.
You got to just go in there.
Linda and David's bedroom was this bright canary yellow, and it was absolutely stuffed with brand new expensive furniture. The room had already these like very expensive built-in shelves and drawers, and then they also had three full dressers just squeezed in, and then this mammoth entertainment center that was balanced on four soup cans to lift it up so you could watch TV in bed.
Sound like anyone you know?
Well, that part I was like, it's our style of home cooking.
Yeah.
So the nightstand on David's side of the bed was overflowing with medications, mostly for his ulcerative colitis and asthma. And then also next to that, a very well-used collection of cigarette cartons, cigars, mm-hmm. and lighters.
Okay.
Linda Brown lay on her side of the bed in a sleeping position. She was covered in blood and making faint noises as she died. Linda had been shot in the chest from about 6 inches away and had bled to death internally over the span of about 15 minutes. So she actually had been alive for a while in the house before anybody came into the room. Huh. The gun was just lying on the bedroom floor. And pretty soon, everybody showed up pretty jarringly. The lights start snapping on around the house and the room filled with paramedics and officers. Linda Brown was rushed to the hospital where she was officially pronounced dead at 4:30 in the morning.
R.I.P.
So back at the house, veteran homicide detective Fred McLean took over and started interviews with David Brown and Patty Bailey. So he started with David in the living room. The living room was the same deal as the bedrooms, just like obscenely filled with expensive new furniture and trinkets. He had couches, two couches, a set of rocking chairs, a set of recliners, all jammed in this little living room so you could kind of choose where you could sit.
Okay.
Like each person had three options.
Yeah, that's weird. That part is not like us, by the way, guys. I just meant the TV up on like some janky ass thing.
The room's accented with unicorns, rainbows, really pricey collector's item dolls, and then these big bald eagle figurines, and then just a disturbing amount of Garfield merchandise, all spanking brand new.
Huh. All just crammed in there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a weird combination because it's like kind of like little girly kind of, and then also weird grandfatherly with the bald eagle figurines, and then also just Garfield, which in 85 is like cynical 16-year-old boy energy. Who is into Garfield in 85, you know?
Well, these guys were super. That was really more Garfield than anything.
Wow.
I think hold on to that feeling about what the living room says.
Okay.
Okay, so like shoulders sagging, he's chain smoking, and David Brown tells investigators that unfortunately, he was pretty sure the shooter was his 14-year-old problem child, Cinnamon Brown. His daughter, Cinnamon, had been living with the family since last fall after her mother kicked her out after this blow-up fight. And 3 weeks earlier, his wife, Linda, had sent Cinnamon to live in an old trailer in the backyard after just months of arguing and teenage drama. And David said, you know, I've done everything to help Cinnamon. He like moved her to a different school, but she cut classes. He tried to get her into therapy and she threatened suicide if he forced her to go. She refused to do chores. She was just out of control, angry, sometimes suicidal. Mm. And things at the house had been really, really tense. So David said that night he had his parents over for a family game night. Linda, his wife, and David's mom, Manuela, got into this argument about sleep training the baby. Like, basically, Manuela was very classic. So, like, Linda's in the kitchen cooking. Manuela goes into the kitchen and tries to take over dinner and won't let her do it. And she's like, oh, my God. And then she tries to put her baby to bed. And Manuela's like, that's not the way you're supposed to put the baby to bed. So it was like an evening of like them wanting to strangle each other.
Okay, great. Just classic mother-in-law, sort of judgmental, controlling, whatever.
So David took his mommy's side, and he and Linda had a fight after his parents left.
God, according to your reporting of what they're talking about on Reddit, that's super common. Where like the husband's mother, I mean, this is not true in our dynamic. Well, we also don't have kids. I don't think it'd be true if we did. But anyways, the husband's mother is very judgmental and controlling of the wife and always inserting herself and forcing her will upon the raising of the grandchild. And then when the wife is like, will you get your mom in line? The husband's just like, you know, I think she makes a lot of really good points. And honestly, you need to get in line. And the real truth is I'm just very scared to confront my mother in any way, shape, or form. So you're pretty much just going to have to do what she says.
Yeah. So I think that's pretty much went down, right? Like, uh-huh. I know. I love Reddit, man. Just drama that isn't your business that you just love it.
yum, yum. Okay, so that was happening in 1985 in the Garfield house.
Yes, and David said, you know, he had this fight with Linda about his parents and everybody went to bed, but he was still worked up. So after everyone was in bed, he got up and went for a drive, and he bought a Dr. Pepper, a Hostess apple pie, a good midnight snack, and then a bunch of comic books at the Circle K.
Yeah.
And then he said he drove down to the beach to think for a little bit and eat his treats, and then drove home. And when he got back, he found Patty holding Crystal, screaming that Cinnamon had tried to kill her. Mm. She had fired a gun into her room, waking her up. And then after a few more gunshots somewhere in the house, Cinnamon had disappeared. So Patty had been hiding with the baby in her bedroom, waiting for David to come home. So McLean, our detective, interviewed Patty next. And Patty was really shy, soft-spoken, sort of, I get the impression, like having this resigned energy. And Patty says she had been living with Linda and David for years, since she was 12 years old. So she really thought of Cinnamon as a little sister. Mm-hmm. And after Cinnamon's mom kicked her out, Patty offered to let Cinnamon stay in her room. So things were okay with everyone until around Christmas, when Patty said Cinnamon started acting moody and erratic, threatening suicide and just fighting with everyone. And Patty said Cinnamon was actually very loved. They had all known each other for years, but it didn't really change anything. Mm-hmm. And eventually Linda had to kick Cinnamon out to the backyard just to give everyone some peace. So Cinnamon still came inside to eat with the family and watch TV, but she stopped speaking to them altogether.
And she had her own trailer in the back.
Mm-hmm.
Man, well, I wish... You know, I hope, first of all, that Cinnamon's not a murderer, and I wish peace upon this, you know, teenager back in 85. I want nothing but good things for her. So those things are true. And also, man, how freaking sick would it be to have your own trailer in the backyard?
You know, I go back and forth. I think it depends on, you know, what the trailer's like and whether or not you feel banished from the house.
I guess, but I feel like as a teenager, you want to be banished, don't you?
I mean... Yeah, maybe.
I don't know. It's sort of like...
I think you have a lot of feelings as a teenager. You know?
Yeah, exactly. I guess that's just my point, you know?
All right. Patty echoed David's story. You know, that night, his parents, Arthur and Manuela Brown, came over to play Uno, which was like the family's hardcore, all-time favorite game.
Yeah, I get it. It's making a comeback these days, too.
There was some tension between Linda and Manuela. And then at some point, Cinnamon got mad that she was losing and stormed out to the trailer. And then later came back inside and asked to spend the night in Patty's room that night. So the girls sat around and watched MTV. And around midnight, Patty decided to get up and go to bed. But she said she was just worried about Cinnamon. Her energy was really weird.
Mm.
And Patty said Cinnamon asked if she could show her something first before Patty went to bed. And she said, sure. And Cinnamon pulled out a gun.
Ugh.
And Cinnamon said she just wanted it for protection out in the van or the camper, but she didn't know how to work it. And Patty told her, you know, I only know about guns from TV, but I think you just cock the top part back and fire the trigger. And then, unconcerned with her troubled, armed step-niece, Patty went to bed.
Okay.
Patty told investigators that she was jarred awake at 2:30 in the morning by the sound of a gunshot. She sat up to see Cinnamon standing as a silhouette in the doorway of her bedroom, and then Cinnamon took off down the hallway. After that, there were two more shots. Patty said she ran and got Crystal from the nursery, hid in her room, and waited for David to come home. She didn't have a phone in her room to call 911, so she thought Cinnamon was still in the house, so she just stayed frozen.
Mm-hmm.
Patty said when David got back from the beach, Patty told him what happened, and David checked the house. But because David was notoriously unable to tolerate the sight of blood at all, he didn't check his bedroom for Linda. Instead, being very brave, he ordered Patty outside with his 8-month-old baby to go look for Cinnamon. So Patty said she looked around the backyard in the dark holding the baby, but she was scared and she didn't find anything. So she came back inside to find David talking to his dad, Arthur, on the phone asking for advice. So at this point, no one had called 911 or checked on Linda. Mm-hmm. And then finally, David hung up and called police. So now, according to David and Patty, it sounded like Detective McLean's job was to find a crazed teen girl on a rampage with a gun. But despite all this, no one was even sure Cinnamon was the shooter. Patty never saw her actually shoot the gun. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were scenarios where Cinnamon could even be a victim of another unknown person sure. in the house. There could be lots of reasons why they weren't finding her right away.
Right.
And moving through the house, McLean found this, you know, pretty suspicious scene in the laundry room. 3 empty prescription bottles written out to David Brown sitting on the washing machine. So it was 2 bottles of narcotic pain reliever and 1 bottle of blood pressure medication. And they were just sitting there next, completely empty, next to an empty Star Trek 2 glass from McDonald's, a collector item.
Okay.
With just a little water in the bottom. So it looked like someone may have taken 3 bottles of pills.
Okay. Okay.
Outside behind the rental, Cinnamon's dented, rusty trailer sat in the dark. Detective McLean popped the door open and was just like hit in the face with the smell of dog poop. Cinnamon wasn't inside, but a puppy was in there and it had just defecated all over the floor. The 14-foot long trailer was a messy kid's room, basically, mm-hmm. for the most part, with toys and different things. It had a small built-in kitchen and then like a portable TV and a little radio and then just like a spare heater. And it drew a strong contrast to the comical opulence of the big house, right? The other teen girl, Patty Bailey, lived inside with expensive things. She had a doll collection. Mm-hmm. She had a big old personal stereo system and a jewelry box that was just filled with different gold pieces. So there was this sort of clear, familiar story emerging here, right? Like new baby and stepkids replace kid from a previous marriage
yeah.
who's pushed aside. They get depressed. They're living in a crappy trailer in the backyard. The kid steals her dad's prescriptions and decides to end it all and take her evil stepmother with her. Right?
Okay, okay.
So McLean left the trailer and decided to put the puppy in the dog run with the family's other dogs. And by now it's morning. It's about 7 a.m. And the puppy is so small, it keeps escaping through the bars of the dog pen and running back to McLean, would just, you know, pick it up and put it back in the pen. So this happened about 3 times. And on the 3rd time he replaced the dog, as he's leaning down, he notices something inside one of the big red dog houses. He bent down and looked inside and found Cinnamon Brown crammed inside the dog house, unmoving.
Mm.
So McLean gently pulls her out. And she's very small. She's barely 5 foot tall. Mm. She looks like a little girl. And she's still alive, but she's really sick. She's covered in urine. She's covered in vomit. And in her hand, she's holding a piece of cardboard with a note handprinted on one side that read, "Dear God, please forgive me. I didn't mean to hurt her." So the 14-year-old sort of hugged on to McLean and he loaded her into the back of a police car and took her to the station for questioning.
Yeah.
And as they're doing this, the first thing that Cinnamon Brown says is my dad okay? Is my dad all right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the second thing she asks is, and how's Linda, by the way? So Cinnamon said she thought she had taken 3 bottles of pills around 2:30 in the morning. And the paramedics at headquarters thought she seemed stable. She may have just vomited everything up. The bottles might not have been full, but uh-huh. her vitals were fine. So Fred McLean led the interrogation of the small teenager who was literally still vomiting into a garbage can. I mean, she had just overdosed.
Yeah.
And then the paramedics just sort of stood watch during the interrogation, planning to take her to the hospital if she got any worse. This just seems completely insane to me.
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
She's a minor. She's overdosing, but that's how it went down.
Okay. Yeah, it's like negligent / I don't know, it coercive seems, or something.
Yeah, and we'll find out. Uh-huh. I mean, I'll say it later, but
the
confession was ended up being thrown out.
Sure.
So they got her into clean clothes and read her Miranda rights, and she seemed completely shocked that she was under arrest. So, you know, that part was kind of odd. And then the interrogation obviously wasn't super productive. She was compliant. She answered questions. Yes, she shot the gun 3 times. Yes, she shot Linda. And she and Linda had a fight. And Linda said she was going to kill her. Linda hated her. That Linda was jealous. And sometimes Linda hit the baby Crystal when David wasn't home. Mm. But Pretty soon, her answers got slow and confused. And at one point, she whispered, "Please don't let them get away with murder." Mm. And she was so loopy, they finally just stopped the interview to take her vitals, and her pulse was at 80. The blood pressure was so low, like it couldn't be read on the machine. So they went straight to the ER, where Cinnamon fell into a coma.
What is going on? Just no one's taking care of these girls. Linda's out there bleeding in a bedroom, and this girl's slips into a coma because they take her to the police station before the hospital?
Yeah. So it turned out Cinnamon had swallowed enough pills to kill her many times over, but she had thrown up the majority of the pills in the doghouse before ingesting all of them. So she did eventually regain consciousness, and then she was booked into a juvenile detention center in Southern California on March 20th, 1985.
That's the next day. So they didn't, they were just like, oh, okay, you're out of your coma and into juvie?
Yeah.
Damn.
So David Brown was just a teenager when his daughter Cinnamon was born. David was born into a low-income family in Arizona in 1952. He was a middle child in a family of 10. His mom, Manuela Brown, was of Mexican descent, but even though they looked very similar, he really downplayed his ethnicity, and he very much throughout the book dabbled in casual racism.
Oh, like I'm white and we're the best kind of situation.
Yeah, yeah. Just always saying the most. Just he says some. There's a lot of quotes because he just talked a lot and he was recorded, and so he just says the most awful things all the time. So casually,
okay.
Just like, oh my god.
Okay.
In regards to his childhood, David, for the most part, is an unreliable narrator. His mom was abusive. She wasn't abusive. He had a great childhood. He had a horrific childhood. You know, nobody really knows where the truth lies. But at any rate, his family moved to California. And after that, he dropped out of the eighth grade and ran away from home at the age of 14. At 15, he met his first wife, Brenda, who was also 15. She was the oldest of 11 kids, the daughter of a single mom with no money. And Brenda was the surrogate mother to her siblings. She was parentified. And David was her Superman, right? He swooped in, picked her up, and they ran away together and started a life. And the two teens spent like a couple of years semi-homeless, moving around until Brenda got pregnant. And at 17, they were married with permission from their parents, and Brenda gave birth to Cinnamon Darlene Brown. Mm. With Cinnamon and David, it was love at first sight. David loved his new baby. He was so proud of her. At the time, he was kind of like a short, chubby Elvis. He had that big pompadour hairdo, and he drove a motorcycle. He'd load her on the back of the motorcycle and like drive her around the neighborhood. And he was like, you know, very much a talker. He was very much into almost bragging about his struggles with ulcerative colitis. His favorite topics of conversation were colon cancer and sexy ladies.
Sure.
He considered himself like quite the ladies' man. So he was super gross with women, constantly hanging out of cars, leering any woman. He was always checking out the chicks. David got his GED and used a state program to enroll in the Control Data Institute in LA. And that eventually led him to the very lucrative world of computer data recovery. And that'll come back later.
Okay.
So as a teen husband, David developed his hallmark behaviors. He was controlling, demanded sex multiple times a day, wouldn't allow Brenda to wear makeup. He was furious when she got her driver's license to surprise him. He did not want her driving. And after a while, he asked for an open marriage just on his end.
Uh-huh.
Brenda, of course, agreed. But of course, she wasn't allowed to do anything, like not even have lunch with her friends. So in this relationship, they lasted about 3 years. And soon he divorced Brenda for an affair partner, demanding full custody of Cinnamon. But teenage Brenda would remain his ideal for all partners moving forward. He gravitated towards the young, the agreeable, those desperate for a white knight, to come and rescue them.
Just to waddle over.
To waddle over.
Cloud of cigarette smoke, hostess cake in hand.
In the course of his life, David Brown was married 6 times, always in a daisy chain fashion. So every new wife was an extramarital girlfriend at some point. Mm-hmm. He married his second wife, Lori Carpenter, in October 1974 and divorced 4 years later because, surprise, David was already hooking up with his third and fifth wife, Linda Marie Bailey. Mm-hmm. In the mid-70s, David was living in Riverside, California with Cinnamon and his second wife, Lori. And 2 houses down from David lived the Bailey family. His introduction to the Bailey family marked the point at which David spread his wings as a full-on piece of human garbage. Linda Bailey, like Brenda, had 10 siblings. And a single alcoholic mother, Ethel Bailey. They lived off welfare. They didn't have any food like noodles, rice, anything processed and then or cheap. And then they went hungry a lot. Mm. And David gained access to the family with this tragic story. He told Ethel Bailey he was dying of colon cancer and wanted to hire her girls to help him around the house. He'd be dead in 6 months. So he's always complaining. He'd come over, complain about bleeding out of his butt. And, okay. But he didn't die.
Just a lot of bloody buttholes.
He just stuck around, lurking, bringing the kids stuff like pizza and hamburgers, whole turkeys, baked hams, store-bought clothes. He even took them to Disneyland like a creepy fairy godfather. And at the time he met Linda, she was 13, and David was 22 years old.
Okay, so that's like the... Like, I know the word groomer gets thrown around all the time now. This is a legitimate groomer.
Yes.
Okay.
David made his entry point in, like, dating the Bailey girls with Pam Bailey, who was around the more acceptable age of 16. So she was the second eldest Bailey girl. But soon he swapped Pam for Linda, who was around 15 when they started dating. And David finally ditched Lori, who had been married to him the entire time he was dating the next door teenage girls. In 1979, Linda Bailey became Linda Brown when she married Davis in Las Vegas at the age of 17 with her mother's permission. David divorced her 2 months later. David married his fourth wife a few months later in May 1980, but by Christmas, he had just moved Linda straight back in his house with his fourth wife, and by January, he divorced his fourth wife and exchanged her for Linda, who became now his fifth wife.
Okay. Are the women, do they talk about him in this book and what was so great about him, or what was so...
I think he knows how to pick them, you know? Like, I think he knows how to find people who...
are susceptible to his version of manipulation.
Yeah. And knows how to find people who need something, you know, who are vulnerable.
Because you're saying he's also making money.
Yeah. He's making a lot of money.
Okay.
Yeah. So by now, David was making fantastic money. He was doing data recovery with his business. He creatively named Data Recovery.
That's the kind of branding we have always needed, you know?
It's just something obvious.
Yeah.
So remember, this is back in the days of like physical floppy disks and stuff. So David had developed a fairly simple thing he called the process and kept it a secret he guarded with his life. The only other person he taught the process to was his young wife, Linda. And according to Ann Rule, quote, his technique required little more than patience, Q-tips, rubbing alcohol and non-oily detergent. Because when we're saying data recovery, we're not saying like hacking into a computer system. You're just like cleaning disks, physical disks.
Yeah. I won't say who, but I do know someone who got a very high contract job to destroy data. And he just, and it was like, he didn't know what to do at all. So, and he showed up to this place and it was like super legitimate and very like, there was all these people watching and he just pulled out a drill and then just drilled through these hard drives and everyone was like, okay, very good. This guy really knows what he's doing. He's like, got it. Just acted like he knew what he was doing. So funny. Oh, anyways.
Well, this whole process was, you know, not that complicated, but it mm-hmm. brought in hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. It was this very competitive thing at the time.
That's and hilarious. It's just like someone who gets paid to like blow on Nintendo cartridges or something.
Exactly. And that money bought David a lot of power and respect. He tended to surround himself with less fortunate family members and young women with little formal education, like Linda, who was a high school dropout.
Yeah.
And they were all people who David could significantly impact with his benevolence, his promise of employment with data recovery, his money, his extravagant gifts.
Baby, I'll get you 2-3 couches.
People who would stay loyal to David, right? Mm-hmm. And treat him with reverence, like the big, big boss. And also people like Linda's youngest sister, 12-year-old Patty Bailey.
Not to be confused with the older sister, Pam.
Right. Gotcha. Patty's our girl, Patty.
Okay, right.
So Patty was about 7 when she first met David, who she always really looked up to. She really admired. Mm-hmm. When she was 12, she was the last girl living in the Bailey home, and she was experiencing sexual abuse by her brothers. Mm. So Linda and David swooped in and moved Patty into their home where she could basically have anything she wanted. She could have food anytime she wanted for the first time. She could get, you know, good clothes, toys, whatever, right? Yeah,
Garfield toys, a lot of Garfield. Mm-hmm.
As for Cinnamon, she was sent between houses based on how annoyed her parents were with her. So with the introduction of the Bailey sisters, David's interest in his daughter petered out. So Cinnamon was around, but not a priority. And that was basically David's little cult. Three girls who had only known David's version of the world or a world of abuse and poverty. He pulled Patty out of school. So despite Cinnamon being a few years younger than Patty, all three girls had about the same level of formal education. Like they were pulled out early in high school.
Gotcha.
Basically, they just spent a lot of time with David's parents, who were also very much in the cult of David, right? And like paying homage to him, being really connected to him. Mm-hmm. And, playing Uno, camping, shooting in the desert, riding ATVs. They were always kind of getting into stuff.
Yeah, I'm loving these midnight snacks of Dr. Pepper and Hostess cakes under the moonlight by the lake.
Yeah.
I mean, that might be a lie. He might not have done that. But that sounded pretty good, you know?
I know, you love cake. Linda.
I do.
Linda gave.
I can't believe people have the freedom to do that. I mean, I know that I could do that. I just wouldn't do that, I think, because I can't eat like that. You know, I don't want the health ramifications of just eating cake at midnight and drinking soda by the lake. But it sounds so good.
You eat cake sometimes, and then but you only do it when you're feeling like wild. But I think sometimes, you know, you just need to be sitting in the dark and just take a breath and be like, you know, right now I think I really need a piece of cake, and then just enjoy it in the moonlight, you know?
Yeah, I know. It sounds great.
I think you have enough cake reserves to be able to do that.
Okay, thanks. You're empowering me. Thank you.
Linda gave birth to Crystal in July 1984. And unlike his experience with Cinnamon as a broke teenage dad, David was now flush with cash. He went all out. This baby would get everything that David, Linda, Patty, and Cinnamon never had when they were babies. So he upgraded their rental to a 3-bedroom home, one room obviously for Linda and David, one for Patty, and then one for the new baby. A totally over-the-top nursery packed with dozens and dozens of Care Bears and unicorns. There were 6 different mobiles, like, cluttering the ceiling, and then the murals were covered in, I mean, the walls were covered in murals.
God, I could be wrong, but I just feel like 85 is just peak, you know, American consumer, like, things are just awesome, like Care Bears, you know, and just fun. I bet you the wallpaper was dope. You know, it's just like everything's neon and cartoony and bright. And I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's obviously no room for cinnamon in this space, but they did put a little pull out bed on the floor of Patty's room for Cinnamon to sleep when she visited. But in the fall of 1984, Cinnamon and her mother, Brenda, had this big blowout fight. And like usual, Cinnamon was flung over to her father and eventually stored in a camper in the backyard for convenience. A few months later, in March 1985, Linda was dead and Cinnamon was charged with her murder. Mm.
I now get why you kind of push back against my romanticization of sleeping out in the trailer. It's not all sunshine and guns and roses the way I had it in my brain. You know?
Yeah, you know. I mean, I think it just depends on your perspective. Some kids love sitting in a trailer, man.
Yeah.
After Linda died, the whole world sort of fell apart. All of David Brown's sicknesses flared up. His ulcerative colitis got really bad. He just laid in bed while a traumatized 17-year-old took care of his infant daughter. And all the silent, unacknowledged work that was Linda's domain just piled up. The house was filthy. The dogs in the back were infested with fleas and died one after another. David's parents, Manuela and Arthur, moved in to help, but they were both really annoyed and confused as to why Patty Bailey was still living at the house. And Cinnamon sat in Ventura School, which was a California Youth Authority facility. So basically a baby prison. Detective Jay Newell was now working on Linda Brown's murder case with the district attorney's office. So he would stay with this case for years. Remember this guy. He features very heavily throughout this episode and the next episode.
Okay. What's his name? Say it again.
Detective Jay Newell. And he works with the district attorney's office as an investigator.
Okay.
So Newell got to work to get a picture of Cinnamon. So he started interviewing friends and family to sort of figure out exactly what happened leading up to the murder. Two interviews that stuck out were with Cinnamon's best friend, Krista Tabor, and Cinnamon's mother, Brenda Sands. So Krista Tabor painted a totally different picture of Cinnamon. She said Cinnamon was basically pretty normal. She did stuff like pull pranks at school and cut class to go to the beach, but she wasn't violent. She was sweet. She didn't do drugs or drink. She dated really innocently, like only public daytime dates with nice boys, but that her dad, David, was super, super strict. Around the time of Linda's murder, Cinnamon was actually in the middle of a 3-month grounding for talking back. So that meant no phone at all and no friends. She was basically under a lock and key. In fact, Krista said her dad punished her constantly. She was always on restriction. And David would sometimes lock Cinnamon inside their fenced yard so she only had access to the trailer and couldn't leave the property. She wasn't even allowed to give her friends her phone number or tell them where she lived. And then when Detective Newell tried to talk to Brenda Sands, it was a total crap show. Like, David had gotten to Brenda first. He convinced her that Detective Newell was public enemy number one, that she should never talk to anyone from the DA's office, which I kind of get, right? So the first time Newell went over to Brenda's house, she chased him off the porch. She was suspicious and terrified. But eventually, Newell wore Brenda down and got some more information. Brenda told Detective Newell that David and Patty had coached her on what to tell him. Mm-hmm. So David told me that Cinnamon had overdosed on some of his prescription drugs. He told me not to tell you detectives that Cinny was always a good behaved girl. And Brenda said she found it odd. Cinnamon wasn't suicidal. They spoke almost every day on the phone. She was a sweet kid and they had arguments, but it was never anything that they didn't get over, even the last argument that they had. She said David had told her Cinnamon declared she would run away if David ever sent her back to Brenda's house. So Brenda just didn't push it. But she hadn't exiled Cinnamon to David's house or anything like that. And then Brenda told a super odd story, one that Detective Newell would start to hear over and over again.
Uh-oh.
Brenda insisted that something sinister was going on at David Brown's house, that Cinnamon told her the girls had overheard Linda talking to her twin brother, Alan Bailey, on the phone, talking about murdering David Brown.
Mm.
And this was secondhand gossip from a 14-year-old, maybe a teen with a flair for the dramatic. Like, it seemed a little out there considering David, Patty, and Cinnamon never mentioned anything like that in their interviews. And Brenda didn't know why Linda and her twin would want to kill David, just that the girls had overheard this conversation. So Detective McLean kind of filed that story away for later. It seemed so odd.
It's like third hand information, and she could just be like, I'm gonna kill David.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So he did, of course, though, set up an appointment with Alan Bailey just to feel him out. Uh-huh. Linda's twin.
Yes.
But Alan didn't know what the hell Newell or Brenda was talking about. In the interview, Alan Bailey was thin. He's missing a few teeth. He's really withdrawn and just worn out from crying. And Alan said, you know, I didn't have the best relationship with David, and in the past few months Cinnamon had been really rude to him, but he had never even joked about killing David. Like, yeah. He's like, I have no reason to even do that.
Yeah, and it seemed like he had a genuine sort of loving relationship with his twin sister.
Yeah, like, yeah, they were very close. So a bunch of eye-raising stuff, right, with like these interviews kind of came out. But in the end, it just wasn't enough to outweigh the overwhelming evidence against Cinnamon Brown. So even though Detective Newell and the DA's office thought there was a lot more to the story that wasn't coming out, Cinnamon was their only reasonable suspect in the murder of Linda Brown.
Yeah, and she has confessed to it.
Yeah, and there's motive and, you know, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, and probably some sort of version of forensics, or it was like, was the gun that killed Linda the same gun that Cinnamon showed Patty?
Yeah, and she had gunpowder residue on her hands, and so did Patty, but it was more trace. And there are ways and there's reasons why, like, gunpowder residue would have, like, potentially, like, gone around and other people would have had it. So it's kind of like she definitely had gunpowder residue on her hands.
What about this note? Was it her handwriting on the cardboard?
Yeah. Okay. So she wrote it. Cinnamon's trial began August 7th, 1985. While Brenda had been visiting, her father had drastically cut down his visits, saying he was wilting like a flower from all the stress, and his colitis wouldn't permit him to leave the house. He did throw money at the trial, though. He shelled out for a top-notch defense attorney for his daughter, who entered a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity. The confession Cinnamon made that night during her overdose was deemed inadmissible evidence, obviously, right? She was just too out of it. But Detective Jay Newell did find another confession Cinnamon made to a healthcare worker after she came out of her coma. It was a medical student working with Cinnamon who recorded it as part of her medical history. Mm-hmm. And it pretty much corroborated everything Cinnamon had said in her original confession, as well as the statements from Patty and David. And, you know, Cinnamon's stepmother had threatened to kick her out of the house. They were arguing. David got frustrated and left the house. And then Cinnamon shot Linda, took a bunch of her father's prescription pain medication, and went out to hide in the doghouse. And the prosecution desperately needed the second confession, as it was the only recorded account of Cinnamon's version of events leading up to Linda's murder, because Cinnamon had totally lost any memory of that night. She had complete amnesia. Cinnamon had undergone several psychiatric evaluations since her arrest. And a few weeks after her arrest, she told her psychiatrist she just literally couldn't remember anything that happened that night. So she was diagnosed with depression, psychogenic amnesia, and dissociative disorder. By the time of the trial, Cinnamon said she still didn't remember anything, so her lawyer declined to have her testify.
I'm having just so much compassion for this girl. I don't know if it ends up she's like a cold-blooded child killer. I mean, killer as a child, you know what I'm saying? So maybe, I don't know, but man, I just feel for her.
Yeah.
At this point in your manipulation of me.
Yeah.
You know.
I got you, boy.
Yeah, you're evil.
Patty testified for the prosecution. David said he was too sick to attend the trial, but sent a letter bolstering the prosecution's murder case against Cinnamon. So both
at home bleeding out the butthole.
Just sticking it to his daughter.
No wonder he can't see any blood. He's like, it just reminds me of my old butthole. Anyways.
Cinnamon's lawyer argued that she had been legally insane at the time of the murder. The prosecution claimed it was premeditated, cold-blooded murder. Mm-hmm. And on August 12th, 1985, Cinnamon was found guilty of first-degree murder. So the next phase of the trial was her sanity hearing. And while it was odd that Cinnamon couldn't remember the night Linda was killed, her psychiatric evaluation showed no evidence of psychosis. She really just seemed like a normal, intelligent kid. And there was no other thing besides this memory lapse that they could point to. So the judge ruled in favor of the prosecution, deeming Cinnamon legally sane and her conviction would stand. At Cinnamon's sentencing hearing on Friday, September 13th, David Brown finally made an appearance. Detective Newell was in the courtroom and watched David come in and take a seat in the back of the courtroom behind Brenda. And shockingly, Newell noticed he seemed really playful and happy. He was teasing Brenda. He was kicking the back of her chair, playing with Brenda's hair like a teenager, while Brenda just sat there totally grief-stricken.
Oh, and now he's out here trying to get, he needs a new wife, so he's going back. He's pulling an old trick and just bringing an old one in for another freaking ride around the racetrack or whatever you say.
Cinnamon was sentenced to 27 years to life for first degree murder. And because she was a minor at the time of the crime, Cinnamon would stay at the Ventura School until she was older. But actually, here's the deal. For minors involved in crimes like this, the target incarceration time was actually only about 6 years. And that if she kept her nose clean, she'd most likely be out of prison by her 21st birthday. Mm-hmm. But at the time, no one bothered to explain that to Cinnamon. So as far as she was concerned, she was going to be in prison until she was well into her 40s.
Yeah, that's like cruel and unusual punishment, just not to make sure a child has some sort of conception of what is happening to them.
Yeah. And she really didn't like a lot of the stuff that they were talking about. She was like, I don't understand.
Yeah. So what, and then, so this whole like, well, you know, guilty and not insane or whatever. They just thought she was lying about the amnesia, or they could prove, like, everyone was like, oh, she has amnesia and she's totally sane and therefore guilty.
I think that they're not mutually exclusive. Mm-hmm. Like, she could have amnesia about the night because the night was traumatic.
Sure.
But they're basically saying up until that point, she didn't display any sort of psychosis. Mm-hmm. Or afterwards, right? So after the sentencing, Jay Newell ran into David Brown's sister in the parking lot, one of his many siblings, and her name was Susan Salcido. She was in the parking lot with Brenda Sands, and they were both devastated. And Susan casually unloaded quite a bit of valuable information on Detective Newell. Susan Salcido spoke with Linda a few weeks before Linda died. Mm-hmm. And she said Linda was miserable, saying all she did was fight with David. Susan asked if it was because of Cinnamon living there. Is that why you're fighting? And Linda said, no, no way. Cinnamon is fine. My sister Patty is the problem. And Linda told her Patty was being really strange and violent. She had somehow killed one of Cinnamon's puppies. And David and Linda were so concerned about her behavior that Linda stopped letting her babysit Crystal alone. Susan said that Linda told her the only reason Cinnamon was living in the trailer was because Patty didn't want to share a room and David gave Patty anything she wanted. And now the family was scandalized, the Brown family. Patty and David were constantly together. Crystal was practically living with Manuela and Arthur Brown while David and Patty went off and did whatever. And Susan also threw in that after Cinnamon was arrested, David and Patty stopped by her place too to coach her into saying Cinnamon was abnormal and suicidal. So,
okay, so now maybe Patty and David are the murderers, which I guess I thought maybe was true from the beginning. But Patty, the little sister.
Yeah.
Okay, so right now we have, there's lots of people that could be like murderous right now. We have Cinnamon.
Yeah.
We have Patty. We have David.
Yeah.
The baby, I'm going to go ahead and say, is not, didn't kill anyone. And, you know, it sounds like, Linda's the victim, you know, but.
Alan, her brother.
Okay, Alan's in the mix. But he hasn't really exhibited any crazy violent stuff. There's no real idea that it could be him, is there?
Well, stuff comes out later.
Oh, my God. I guess she does have all these siblings.
My transition sentence was, so rut-row, Charlie Brown. And I realized I just mixed Scooby-Doo and Charlie Brown together.
I hate Mondays. Okay.
So it was all just too much. Jay Newell knows something hinky was going on, and he just couldn't drop the case yet. So when Newell could take time away from other investigations, he just kept digging into David Brown. Mm-hmm. After her conviction, Cinnamon Brown was largely abandoned. She had no telephone or address for her dad, just a P.O. box. David came once in a while, but said he was too sick to make the drive. He was pretty sure he was dying, but he promised he was working on overturning her conviction and getting her out of prison.
A lie, right?
While David wasn't returning her letters or visiting, he always made sure that she had money and things. Cinnamon said, I had a color TV, Walkman, and bear pictures on my walls and frames with pictures of my family. I had a lot of things. I also had pink curtains on my windows to cover up the bars to make it look more normal. Mm. And David also kept her commissary account well-funded so she could buy whatever she wanted. Mm. So he threw money at it, but never really showed up. Cinnamon started taking classes again, working to graduate high school. She was no trouble at all. She got a part-time job in prison. She didn't join any gangs, kept to herself. She didn't have any, you know, behavioral problems. Her only issue was the parole board, because while she was a model prisoner, she still hadn't recovered any memory of the night of the killing and was refusing all psychiatric treatment. So the board saw this as a sign she wasn't dealing with the crime. She wasn't acknowledging her culpability, mm-hmm. which they felt she needed to properly rehabilitate. So she wasn't getting any time off for good behavior, and she would never be considered for parole at this rate, right? She was just stuck in limbo. Detective Newell kept stalking David Brown, and the guy was just a gold mine of surprises. Just 3 weeks after Cinnamon's conviction, David paid for a $330,000 house in cash in Anaheim Hills, which was a super fancy area of Orange County. And there in the new house, Patty lived with David and Crystal and took to dressing up in Linda's clothes and jewelry. And like the person accused of plotting against David, Linda's twin, Alan Bailey, was back working for data recovery again as if nothing had happened. Mm-hmm. Then in the summer of 1986, David Brown married Patty Bailey, making her his sixth wife.
Of course. How old is she at this point?
17. Later, Patty would say David married her because he knew he was dying of some mysterious disease and wanted her to have custody of Crystal. David would later say the whole thing was actually a hoax, that he did it as a favor to Patty's friend who had gotten accidentally pregnant and was trying to pressure her boyfriend into marrying her. So they all like went to Vegas and got married together to try to make this guy, you know, do the right thing, I guess.
Okay. So, okay.
That's David's story.
I mean, did they get married in Vegas? Is there some like truth to that?
Well, David said he purposely filled out the paperwork wrong. It was all a big joke. But spoiler alert, they were totally legally married and filed their paperwork out, totally correctly.
Oh, so when he said hoax, it was like, oh, we just made these people believe we got married.
Yeah, but he had a marriage license on file. They even had a detailed prenup agreement, leaving Patty with pretty much nothing that was also on file with his lawyer.
Great.
Even though apparently it was a joke, at the time, David insisted they keep the marriage a secret from everyone. Patty wasn't allowed to tell a soul, especially Cinnamon, who Patty had cut contact with completely at this point. The only person who consistently visited from the Brown clan was her grandpa, Arthur, who kept her informed of some of the drama going on at the house. Around December 1986, Cinnamon told staff at the Ventura home that her grandpa had told her he knew who killed Linda and would reveal it when the time was right. So this gets recorded and Jay Newell catches wind of the information. Mm-hmm. So in January 1987, just like the next month, Newell goes to this fancy new house in Anaheim Hills to try to interview Arthur. So at this point, nobody at the family in the family knows what Jay Newell looks like. So mm-hmm. he's able to kind of slip in and be like, hey man, what's going on? Newell got actually a few minutes in with Arthur Brown, who was outside gardening. He was just terrified, like really scared to say anything. Uh-huh. But he does say enough to give Jay Newell the impression that Arthur blamed Patty for the murder.
Blame Patty.
Yeah. Okay. He says, Patty did it. Uh-huh. She's the one. You have to look at Patty.
Okay.
And then David Brown drives up. He comes home unexpectedly. So Jay Newell's standing there. Arthur looks like he's going to die. He's terrified. So Newell just on a dime pretends to be a real estate agent. Mm-hmm. So he has this pleasant conversation with David Brown about houses and leaves. Arthur is sitting there, you know, torn, right? Because he's terrified of his son, but also, you know, loyal to his granddaughter who's in prison right now. So he holds up the con. He's trying to like keep it together, but he cracks after about 6 hours and then confesses to his son that the real estate agent was actually Jay Newell, an investigator from the DA's office. So that night, David blew up at his dad. He had Patty burn their marriage certificate and prenup in the barbecue, but too bad, Chad. They're already on file in a clerk's office somewhere.
Yeah.
It's not like they were the only copies, Super David.
Well, what the hell was... Why? Like, oh, now I'm going to get divorced because he just knows it looks bad?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, I think it looks really bad. Yeah, and it could also point to a motive,
okay,
right?
Okay.
David was starting to feel the pressure of Newell's investigation and darkness descended on the Brown home. And then, just a month later, Patty got pregnant. Patty had told David that she was infertile so she could surprise him with a baby. that's what happens if you have sex with teenagers. Not a great plan.
Yeah, just everyone's firing on all genius cylinders.
David was furious. I mean, it's it's not at all her fault. I mean,
no, of course. It's just like it's just a childish thing to do because she's a child.
Yeah,
and he's dumb and thinks you can just burn something in a barbecue pit.
They're just really they are firing on all cylinders.
Yes,
David was furious. He tried to force her into getting an abortion, but she wouldn't do it. So he told her that she couldn't say they were married to anyone and she had to claim the baby belongs to a different man. A man who'd ran out on her. He said, it's some Greek guy named Doug who drives a Trans Am. That's what you're going to tell people. He even had flowers sent to the house with uh-huh. cards signed Doug
okay,
to
great.
Complete the ruse.
Okay, good.
Patty gave birth September 1987 to a girl and named her Heather Nicole. David made Patty pay her own hospital bill. By now, Patty was 19, a dead ringer for Linda, about the same age Linda was when she had Crystal. Mm-hmm. But this time, there wasn't the over-the-top nursery. David wouldn't acknowledge the baby at all. Patty still lived with David and his parents, but by now, Manuela was openly hostile to Patty. They fought constantly. Patty attempted suicide several times. It was just horrible, you know,
yeah,
horrible situation. So David figured to solve everything, he just needed a bigger house, a split residence, so he could separate Patty from his mother. And this place that he, the next place that he bought was this huge compound with a big pool that was lined with Grecian statues.
This, come on, data recovery. He's just got a toothbrush just polishing floppy disks. That's gonna come crumbling down, right?
And Cinnamon,
yeah,
wasn't aware of any of it, right? Uh-huh. She wasn't aware of the houses, the marriage, the baby. She didn't even realize Patty was still living with David. David had pretty much stopped visiting Cinnamon. No one responded to her letters. Mm. David said he was too sick to visit, dying in and out of the hospital. But then she would manage to get her grandparents on the phone to check on him, to be like, oh, is he okay? Yeah. And they'd be like, oh yeah, he's just out at the store, honey, doing errands or whatever. Right. So she starts to see this bigger picture.
Yeah, she knows he's lying. And he's definitely not doing anything to help her conviction get overturned or anything, right?
Grandpa Arthur supplied information, for instance, that Patty had gotten herself pregnant by a Greek named Doug, which surprised Cinnamon quite a bit. She was like, Patty never even dated. Uh-huh. My dad's so controlling. That seems really strange. And David, when he'd sporadically talked to Cinnamon, would deny most of what Arthur was telling Cinnamon, that, you know, he was saying, I'm so sick. And by the way, honey, you wouldn't want to come home anyway. It's not any fun here. Everybody's fighting. It's way better in prison.
Yeah, with your pink curtains and your bear pictures.
There was no new lawyer working on her case.
Yeah,
she hadn't met anyone in years. No private investigator coming over to take her statement. No indication that she was anything but a forgotten child in prison. And she started to feel like her father was full of shit. By now, Detective Newell felt he had enough information to have a real sit-down talk with Cinnamon. But because she was still a minor, he wasn't allowed to contact her directly without David Brown's permission. So Newell put together a packet of photos. Photos of the beautiful houses where David and Patty lived, the pool, the luxurious grounds, fancy cars, their vacations. And he gave the packet to her parole officer to give to Cinnamon if he thought it was appropriate.
Okay.
On July 19th, 1988, about 2 weeks after her 18th birthday, Detective Newell got a phone call from Cinnamon. And after years of silence, after wasting her teen years behind bars, Cinnamon said of her father, quote, he was in the wrong for what he did, and I was too young to realize it. I know now that it's time for him to take the responsibility for the crime that's taken place. I was a little bit involved because I knew what was going to happen, but I didn't actually do the murder. And we'll pick up next week.
Oh,
starting with what she says happened.
Yes, okay.
And moving into a whole avalanche of crazy. It gets so much crazier.
Yeah, yeah.
David does not go down kicking, I'll just say that.
He does not go down kicking?
Just kidding. He goes down kicking.
Okay.
That's what I meant to say.
Okay, good. All right. Well, hey, we left him on a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
Yeah, you really are. You're taking after Ann Rule, huh?
Man.
Getting good.
Yeah, I guess. Ann Rule is way better. I just read her book and now I'm telling you about it.
I know. Well, you know, I was literally being, you know, what's the word? Sarcastic or whatever. Because you said the kicking thing wrong. I was talking trash.
Oh, okay.
I wasn't actually giving you a compliment, even though I love you.
I worship like you. Were. What
I know.
Lie.
I know. Well, I'm taking after David, you know?
How dare you?
Okay, look, everyone. Now I just want to eat lasagna also. I can't stop thinking about it because of Garfield, you know? Cake, lasagna. This is really, really a lot of sensory sort of triggers for me in this episode. Okay, look, part two is coming out free next week. But if you want to support the podcast, sign up for our Patreon, sign up for our Spotify feed, and unlock part two right now. This is a two-part series. Muriel, you're doing great. I'm loving you. You're the best. Thank you, all you beautiful people, for listening to this podcast. Meryl did all the research. She read. She did all the reading. And then she wrote this whole thing. And then we recorded it in our living room while I, you know, man the ones and twos on the old computer. Now I have to go edit this thing. It's done by us. It's an in-home production. Thank you for tuning in.
Yeah, man. If you want to support the podcast, we've been plugging this, so you know what to do. You can sign up for our stupid Patreon. I'm starting to read this. Sign up for our Patreon. You can sign up for our exclusive Spotify feed. Mm-hmm.
You can follow us on social media. Hey, follow us on YouTube. Are you guys on YouTube? We could use some more subscribers on YouTube. Just hit subscribe and then, you know, you'll never notice you even did it. You know what I mean? Share this podcast with the people in your life. That's like the best thing. Shout out to everyone who listens to us on Audio Mac.
Oh my God, we're loving you guys. It's so fun. They give us just like a geographical breakdown of where people are. So you're like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Somebody's like listening to us in Germany. It's very fun. Yeah. So keep listening, man. It's cool.
Okay. Our music is by Mario Castellini. He's got a bunch of new music on the way. We're very excited for him. We have links to his stuff in the show notes of this episode. Check that out. And, you know, be good to yourself and each other. R.I.P. Jerry Springer. And may all the peace in the world be with you.
Yeah.